Hi everyone, this is Chris Deasy, and it was so good to catch up with Arne Danielson, who works in Switzerland for the Lutheran World Federation. He works in communication there. We first met in 2007 at a conference on film and theology in Copenhagen. And Arne tells us that he used to work in a video rental shop. He became acquainted with film history that way. He went on at university to study theology and was involved in a theology and film group. We talk about the field of theology and film and the possibilities for online communication, including podcasts, which is allowing people to be creative. We learn about Arne's upbringing. He was born, like me, in 1973, in Iceland in his case. He grew up in a small family. He remembers the big forest, which he used to know very well. And he talks about the things that he had forgotten how to do. He talks about why The Empire Strikes Back, which he saw at the cinema three times, is such a key memory for him. We learn about his musical influences and the way that music has been a way for Arne to connect with his own children, how he undertook a study of the way pastors are represented in film, why he chose to do theology for his degree, how film is a good way of understanding and of critique. He talks about being ordained as the first online pastor of the Church of Iceland. This was back in 2008. And we talk about the impact of lockdown on ministry. And Arne talks about what his greatest hopes are once lockdown ends. We learn that his memories are mainly positive. We talk about the role of grief and how our perceptions of grief may be reframed later in life. Arne tells us that his younger self couldn't imagine what he would be doing now. And at the very end, Arne talks about how he reflects with gratitude on his past. It was so good to catch up with Arne Danielson for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is such a pleasure to have Arne Danielson for my latest nostalgia interview. And Arne, we met, it must have been, I think, at the very beginning of 2007.
Yeah, probably something around that. One of these film and religion meetings, conferences.
Yeah, because we met in Copenhagen, didn't we?
We met in Copenhagen for, it was a conference on, was it the Bible in film? I think so.
Yeah.
I can't recall what my lecture was about. I think I was probably speaking about salvation and film, which was the topic I was engaged with at the time.
Yeah, I remember you gave a paper on Levity, which is a film I hadn't seen at the time, with Morgan Freeman.
Yes. A good film, actually.
Yeah. And we work in a very similar kind of area, and it was a privilege to meet you, because I think, were you based in Iceland at the time, is that right?
I was based in Iceland at the time, yes. I was working for the Church of Iceland, and dabbling into research on film and religion on the side.
And what do you do now, Arne?
So now I live in Geneva, Switzerland, and I am working as I was in Iceland with communication, but now for the Lutheran World Federation, which is a communion of 148 Lutheran churches in 99 countries with headquarters here in Switzerland and then operations around the world.
Yeah, and so incredibly busy, and it's interesting how different paths intersect, because it's really funny, because certainly around the 90s and into the 2000s, there was so much research being done, often quite tentatively, but in the area of theology and religion and film. And I met some amazing people, including yourself, who were very much part of that narrative. And it's actually really exciting, because especially, I've always kept a diary, so it's good to go back over sort of those records and the intersection with people who all got very excited, myself included, sort of riding the coattails of this to an extent. I mean, I still work and I still teach in this area, but I do lots of other things as well, perhaps these days. But it was so interesting, because it was people like ourselves who had a background. Certainly mine was in theology, where we did nothing on media. My degree all those years ago in the 90s was never involving film. And suddenly it was this opportunity to engage with film and actually do so through a particular lens that was really enriching academically. And it just kind of meant that the contours changed a bit. And a few people thought, oh, you know, this changes the contours rules and the boundaries of what I considered academic activity to be. So is that you, because I know you taught in this area as well, is that very much how you understood the rhythms of that particular age?
Yeah, I think you captured it quite well. I mean, I was reflecting, because this is a nostalgia interview, I was actually reflecting on what brought me into this. And as a teenager, when I was in high school, I used to work in one of these video rental shops. And that's really what got me into film. I think I worked there for 4 or 5 years, and it was a big shop in Reykjavik, Iceland, which not only had the sort of top 10, top 50 films, but a lot of classic films. And we sort of brought the classic films to Iceland and made them available. And as one of the staff, I watched them. So I got really well acquainted with film history. And then I finished my high school studies and I went to study theology. And I sort of put that aside. Then, okay, now I'm doing theology and film is not really a part of it. And then I graduated. And I was doing what I considered, or sort of on the track to do, some serious studies. And there were some friends of mine in Iceland who had just started a film and religion. They called it a club. They were meeting once a week, and it sort of it was created around a research project. One of them was looking at quotes from the Psalms in the Old Testament in war films. And he wrote a paper on that. And they sort of began meeting once a week to look at these films together and discuss them. And this then became a group which was called, and is still actually active in Iceland, called Deus Ex Cinema, which was doing research into film and religion on different levels, always meeting once a week to have what you could call seminars, which basically consisted of viewing a film chosen by one of the members, and then having a discussion around it, which was enthusiastic and academic at the same time. And we were able to bring together film scholars, theologians, scholars of religion, artists, philosophers, people with very different and varied background for a quite, I would say, wide approach to these studies. And then we began writing, and we did it sort of on two levels. On the one hand, we published a few volumes on the Bible and film, on sort of different thematic areas. We published one book in English on the films of Andrei Tarkovsky. And then we set up a website, which unfortunately only materialized in Icelandic, but that actually had we came up with a sort of a taxonomy of analyzing and describing religious themes in films. Quite progressive at the time. And I think in the end, we had done analysis of 600 or 700 films, which were all available on the website and are still available on the website. But, well, Google Translate can help. And that sort of, following that, when we were in that place, we began reaching out a little bit. And I think that's through one of these meetings that you and I met. And there were two of us from Iceland there, me and Þorkell August Óttarsson, a friend of mine who lives in Norway now and is making films. So I sort of went from being a theologian more into the communication work. And he actually went into filmmaking and has been doing very interesting short films. And I think one or two feature films also. So. But I do think that it was quite innovative at the time. We were, of course, building on a long tradition, but it sort of exploded within the theological studies. And I think the study of popular culture and religion, or of culture and religion, sort of came into its own at that time. And I think it's continued, even if since I moved to Geneva, I've not been able to follow it quite as rigorously. But I think it's continued quite a lot. You probably know more about that.
Well, yes, and it's interesting because I see my own development over the years from a time when you'd sort of see these films, and even you mentioned culture. I guess certainly when I was an undergraduate, often we'd see theology as kind of operating in a vacuum. Of course, we'd look at theology in particular historical context, but there was a sense of this is what this term means. This is what redemption is, and it's just interesting. Because I suppose since I started doing the Nostalgia podcast, I went from seeing what film studies people say about nostalgia, or psychologists or sociologists or anthropologists, or for that matter, theologians, to then discovering that when I engage with people's personal narratives, you find that they've got their own particular apprehension of the past. And it's often the fact that they're in a particular place now and they're doing what we've just been doing, reflecting on the last 15, 20 years and thinking, gosh, this is very different to how we remember it. And we traced that journey and we couldn't have anticipated 15 years ago the way, you know, 15 years ago, I remember having a conversation with you at that conference in Copenhagen. And we were talking about, you know, the number of DVDs we owned. And in my case, I had so many in those days, they were all in my attic. And I used to think, God, what will happen if it gets too hot in the summer or too cold in the winter? And here we are all these years on, and we're talking about streaming, and we're talking about, you know, DVDs were replaced by Blu-ray and then streaming services. And yet, as we were also saying before we started recording, vinyl is also back in vogue. So there's a sense of the old and the new often working completely in tandem. So I think for theologians engaging with culture, there are many levels, meta levels, if you like, on which that can operate.
I think so, and I think for me, I'm quite interested in this intersection between theology and culture overall. And I think it's only become more interesting in recent years. I think we have so much, after 2007, when we see the explosion, for example, of social media and all of the self-expressions, when we see the introduction of the smartphones and cameras, which people can use to make, we've seen online video completely explode into new categories, which can actually be used so to even make short films. So, 30 years ago, it was quite an undertaking to actually produce a 10, 15, 20 minute short film. And I think now it's much easier, and we're even seeing it being done by young creative filmmakers quite rapidly. They're able to take an idea and bring it sort of to a complete product of course it's always difficult, but with much more ease than before. And I think this opens up immense possibilities for theologians, and actually not only for theologians to analyze, but also to practice theology. And I think the possibilities of for example, if you want to speak about or teach film and religion, I remember when we taught our first course at the University of Iceland, which was the first time film and religion had been taught there, we spent the first three sessions, I think, without a single film clip, because we were talking about methodology and explaining this and that. And then we sort of understood, why are we doing this? This could be so much easier if you could actually illustrate. And then we began doing that. And it sort of changed from that. But what would be an ideal format of an article or a book-length treatise about film and religion? Would that be is it a text in a printed format which you can access? Is it a PDF with links to YouTube videos which you can watch? Because it's difficult to, if you leave, you know, and here I suppose I'm thinking a bit as a communicator, is it, how can you make it easier for the people you are trying to reach to actually live through this? Do you tell them you should go watch this film and then read this chapter? Or do you using modern technology, basically link to the place in the film? I find it very interesting, actually.
I completely agree, because I remember probably around the time we met, I was working on a book, or maybe I was reviewing a book, and I remember the publisher stipulating that if there were films mentioned, then on the grounds that not everybody had read the book or would have seen the film, there should be a synopsis provided of the plot of the film. And I thought, in a way, that was terrible, because if the idea that suddenly you almost like say, a good film that deals with redemption is The Shawshank Redemption. Here's the plot of the film. And then you start talking about him being in prison for all these years. It's like, no, that utterly misses what you have to weave it together. I say to my students all the time, please don't recount the plot. I mean, I write film reviews, or, you know, obviously amateurish on Facebook, but, you know, I'm often aware that I'm thinking, you know, whatever I do, I mustn't simply tell the plot of the film, because some people obviously say, oh, don't give away what happens at the end. But sometimes I think, like with good theologies or eschatologies, the end is often the beginning. You know, so the idea that sometimes it's what happens at the end of the film that makes you see everything else before it in a different light. So sometimes you have to be strategic. But you are right, and I think that the idea that you'd have a textbook which contains books that would films that would only ever be, well, you couldn't have anything too recent, because by definition, obviously, you need time in order for a film to be watched and to be reviewed and to sort of enter the canon, as it were. But it's interesting that I'm watching lots of older films during lockdown, re-engaging with those Blu-rays and DVDs from yesteryear. But it is interesting, in the light of what we've just said, that I've found the last couple of, you know, years a really interesting opportunity to engage with new films, but if you like, put out instant reviews and get feedback on them in a way that wouldn't have happened before. So I might see it as a solitary experience. I might go on my own to a cinema in Canterbury to watch a film, but then I've got friends all over the world, literally, who are then saying, oh, on the basis of that, I wouldn't mind seeing that film, or I'm thinking of seeing it tomorrow, you know, that kind of thing. So there are, I think, new possibilities of engaging with research. And I don't think that they were even countenanced all those years ago when it was the monograph as the sole kind of beacon, if you like, the sole way of, you know, measuring somebody's worth or success. If they've, how many books have you published? And although that sort of paradigm is still in place, I think it is shifting. And I think what you've said indicates that that kind of trajectory is very much being in vogue.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I've watched a number of films on recommendation from the film blog of David Bordwell and his wife, which is a you know, I mean, they've published together a number of books, which I found quite useful to understand the language of film and sort of narrative structures in different genres, for example. But I keep coming back to the blog because there is a whole canon of work there, which is actually quite useful. And I think that's probably going to be, I mean, if we think of how academia will develop, I think it's probably going to be more of a requirement for researchers, for scholars, that they are adept at using different mediums to share their research and to connect to others. Because ultimately, I think it's also about that. It's about you can you're working with your students at the university, but there is a whole group of people who might actually be interested in following your work and learning from you and interacting with you. Yeah, that you can reach in a new way now.
Absolutely. And that's actually a really interesting part of the narrative as well, because in the old days, as it were, somebody would have a book out. And actually, that wasn't a bad thing in itself, because it meant that, you know, you didn't know what somebody was doing in the 4 years or whatever it was since their previous book. Or you might see them at conferences and you might get a work in progress, but you'd get the end product. The book would come out and there'd be a bit of a fanfare around that. And then they'd go away again. You might see them again 4 years later, or there might be another book or whatever it might be. But now it's very much part of the process. So people, you know, I might be working on a book, but people will know as much about the process of writing that, or what I'm doing along the way, or what films I'm watching, and the sort of things I do on social media. So it's much more about process now, whereas in the past, it was about the end product, because we didn't have the publicity that was attached or the mechanism, you know, that social media has afforded us to sort of chart those journeys and the, you know, we have the means to an end in the end. And that's something which I think we're still trying to take hold of. I do all these podcasts and I don't for a minute think that there's anything comparable between doing a podcast and writing a book, but in their own different ways, they're both different ways of disseminating the way that we do things and you know, different degrees of authority or precision perhaps. But it's who knows what people will make of podcasts like this in decades or even centuries to come, and whether they might find there are all sorts of ways of finding out about the journey towards a particular goal, whether that's an academic goal or it might be a theological goal or whatever goal it might be, that's some sort of end point of that journey.
And I find that, to be honest, I've always found that I've always found that overall area of work quite interesting. I've been keen on, I mean, my work. So initially I was hired to work for the Church of Iceland, sort of doing communications on a national level, focusing on online communication. And then I went on to become the head of communication. And I've always found these boundaries of online communication interesting. What possibilities do we have of using new media to get a message across, and to influence people, to reach people, to interact with people? And I think we've been living through extremely interesting times when it comes to this, sort of beginning to work when we have the first, second iteration of the web, which is not very interactive, then moving into more sort of interactive websites with the possibility of comments, which are both the positive, good, affirming comments, and also the sort of hate speech, and then the advent of social media, which is developing extremely rapidly. It's quite complicated to keep up if you want to be at the forefront. And now we're seeing almost the sort of going back to radio, but radio in a slower, because a podcast is like a radio show, except it's accessible to all. Everyone can produce, everyone can listen. And normally we will have longer conversations. You have sort of space for a conversation which wouldn't fit into the regular schedule of a radio station. And I think it's so inspiring to see how this is actually allowing people to be very creative, and it's allowing so many voices to be heard that you would never hear. And then you choose on the basis of your interest and you follow, and you know, sometimes I think there are a number of people who are quite successful as podcast hosts who probably would never have gotten a chance in the radio because they didn't quite fit. But actually what they're doing is very inspiring. And I think if we think of the niche of film and religion, I think it's probably way more interesting and there would be way more opportunities to do something which would have a global reach with film and religion now than maybe 20 years ago because of technology, because we're able to reach out as you and I are reaching out. We could sort of set up a group of people from you know, different continents who are all engaging with this and have very fruitful conversations that would expose a much larger group to films that you've never seen. Because we, if we think of the of what's traditionally shown in cinema or what sort of gets promoted with a big release, that's a very small proportion of all the films, and especially films on religion. I think, you know, there is a whole lot out there which we may never discover actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, as you say, because if you were doing something on radio, that would kind of feel like a job. You have to, you know, it might be an ambition that you have. It was certainly an ambition of mine when I was younger. But it's the sort of, you know, am I good enough for it? I have to be interviewed for that. And it's, you know, giving up maybe another career that you've got. With a podcast, yeah. It's something that you can very much do, in some cases, quite literally in your spare time. And that's something which, and it may be a bit more rough and ready, but as technology improves, actually sometimes the quality of what goes out can actually be certainly maybe not as good as something on the radio, but and it may not be as polished, but you can certainly get the guests that you want. You can fill it with the content that's quite bespoke, and you can set the parameters then, and you can almost like say to people, you know, this is the way I do things. And other people might say, people say to me all the time, you know, how do you do a podcast? And I had to ask other people the same question when I started mine. So there is a really a great sense of community building that comes about through through this kind of medium, this kind of discourse.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes. Tell me then how the journey started for you, Arnie, because we were just talking about, you know, we met 15 or so years ago, but what about things like earliest memories? So where and when were you born?
I was born in 1973 in Reykjavik, Iceland. Reykjavik is the capital of Iceland, and Iceland is this tiny island in the North Atlantic, which is famous for volcanoes with unpronounceable names like Eyjafjallajökull and Fagradalsfjall. We have one erupting now, which is you know, great, or could be a boon for the tourist industry, except people can't travel because of COVID-19. I grew up in a, well, fairly small family, mom, dad, and then one younger brother who was born 6 years after me. My parents both worked, and I suppose fairly normal Icelandic childhood. You know, I went to the same school for all of my through all of my primary and teenage years, and then went to a high school and went to university. I used to spend my summers in the countryside. My father was born on a farm and lived there until he was, I think, 20, 21. And I used to spend my summers with some relatives of his. So being a you know, taking care of chores, and I think that's probably quite formative for me. So I would often be 2 or 3 months of the year actually in the north of Iceland, leading a completely different life.
Yeah, and that's interesting, isn't it? That notion of counterpoint, of having something maybe in memory, maybe. I don't know if you ever get to return there, but certainly the idea of having this something that is like outside of time. I used to keep a diary, and I'd always start the diary during the holidays, not during the representative going to school part of the year, but in the sort of the time off. So I'd have more of a record of the unusual or out of sequence or unrepresentative periods than the actual representative period. But of course, that's what you remember, and those holidays, because they were perhaps so different from the rest of the year, they were something to look forward to. And I'm guessing that whether you go back there or in the imagination or in actuality or a bit of both, it sounds like a really precious time that has stayed with you over the years and decades.
I think there are moments, and as I reflect, I haven't been there in years now, also living abroad, but there are sort of moments that, I mean, this is how memory works, at least for me. There are moments or glimpses that stay with you. And there was a big forest where I was, and I felt at times as if I knew every path through the forest and almost every tree in the forest that you could at least climb in, which is a sort of cherished notion. And I think it probably translated into a love for being out in nature. And I've had these glimpses since where I knew how to do something I had completely forgotten I knew how to do. We were at one point, doing some. We were painting a roof, or we were fixing a fence, and the hands sort of just grabbed the equipment and began working. And I was thinking, why do I know this? And then I remembered, yes, I used to do this during the summer.
No, it's incredible, isn't it? That sense sometimes, it's a bit like you see it in movies sometimes where somebody like Gina Davis discovers that she was an assassin or something, and she's like, why have I got all these skills? And it's you're right, but obviously I'm not making that analogy apply specifically in your case, but it is interesting that sometimes that there are those things that I found it. I used to spend an awful lot of time reading pages of teletext, or because we didn't have internet in those days, or listening to the radio. And of course you'd be kind of like replicating the things that went on, and all those years later you suddenly discover that you're still acting and behaving and channeling that. And you meet people from your childhood and they're like, oh, you're just the same. And you suddenly realize why you sound the way that you do, and why maybe in some cases you say things and do things a bit differently from other people because of your sort of quite unique background. So that sounds really precious. So, but what about things like music or film from that period?
I don't think I began watching film. I mean, I watched film as everyone. I remember, I saw Star Wars 3 times. Well, maybe Star Wars is the best example. So the second Star Wars film, The Empire Strikes Back, is one of the most memorable sort of screenings of my childhood. I saw it 3 times at the movies. The first movie I saw more than once at the movies, and it was quite effective. And then I think the statute of limitations allows this. Then when the third movie came out, The Return of the Jedi, we had a VCR, and somehow we had obtained like a bootleg copy of the film, which was probably recorded with a portable recorder in a movie theater. It was gray and grainy and very difficult to watch, but we had a copy, and I watched that movie 50, 60 times. This was a cherished possession. But I mean, I think I was like most boys. I probably mainly watched the sort of high profile movies. Music, what was on the radio? And I think the first sort of bands I began following a bit, actually, where I was during my summers. There was an older boy there, and he used to listen to the Smiths. So I got to know the Smiths, and some of that music. And then, as I grew a bit older, I was following, Prince and Alanis Morissette, and then in university I fell for Johann Sebastian Bach and his music, which then became so. I listen to everything basically.
It's interesting when things move that way, isn't it? That sometimes, you know, you start off listening to all that, the current or the trendy stuff, or, you know, it could be the other way around, of course. But then you discover that suddenly the interests go in a direction that you know, your younger self would never have anticipated. And in my case, actually, I tend to be a bit more sort of the same. Like I used to grow up with all sorts of music in the early 80s, all the sort of chart stuff from that age. And I still listen to it and I still enjoy it. And I haven't entirely moved on. But I also think I'm okay with that. I suppose at one point I thought, gosh, I'm also watching all the old films from the 90s. It's like, yeah, but I do watch lots of new films. So I think I'm okay with that. But I'm not interested in contemporary music in the way that I was 30 or 40 years ago when I was in my, you know, before my teenage and in my early teenage years. But film is interesting because that tends to evolve. And I do enjoy the whole comparison. You know, if I see something at the cinema now and I think that's just like one of those early 90s thrillers, blah blah blah, you know, and so that there's a sense of nostalgia in all of that. You're watching a new film, but you're reading it through the lens of something autobiographically as well. It sounds like you're doing much the same with music as well.
Yeah, I've also tried. Actually, I've seen music as a way of connecting with my children. So I've tried to follow what is popular now and listen to it to some extent, because, I mean, often it's fine music because it creates a point of connection with them. This is what, if it's what they're listening to, then I think it's worthwhile to relate to it. And then, yeah.
Yeah, that's the funny thing about children, because my children are interested in, they're very young, but they're interested in music of which I have no interest or knowledge. And I sort of think, where do they get it from then? You know, how do they know? I mean, in many cases, it might be like from a Disney cartoon or something, but they certainly know exactly what to look for, shall we say. And I guess I was probably the same, because my parents were like, oh, you know, the music was never as good in the early 80s when I was growing up as it was two or three decades earlier when they were my age. And I guess I'm doing exactly the same thing now with my children. You know, I've got no interest in the stuff that they're interested in, but also equally, they've got no interest in the stuff that I listen to. They go, Daddy, your music is rubbish. And I've got to shrug my shoulder and say, you know, okay, I'll be a hypocrite if I try and and argue with you.
But I think that's okay. I mean, I think it's also a part of the sort of delineation that we like what we like and they like what they like. And I think to the extent we can connect to it, it can become a point of connection. It's not the only point of connection either. So,
yeah. And how did you end up then? Because I'm assuming that you did theology at university, but I'm not entirely sure if I'm accurate in that. But certainly, am I right in thinking that you did something very similar in that kind of area?
I did. I basically went through the regular theological studies in Iceland, which is a 5-year program where you study, you know, Greek and Hebrew and exegesis and practical theology and systematic theology. And I was actually going to specialize in systematic theology. That was my, I was going to go for a sort of, I wanted to teach because I wasn't quite keen on being a pastor. I you know, most of my classmates were there to become pastors. And when I was asked, I sort of brushed it off. No, probably not. I'm doing something else. And I was studying, you know, the church in Iceland is a Lutheran church, and I was studying Martin Luther's theology, and I was sort of going to be a very dull academic in that sense. And then I was whisked away from it, which was a sort of, I think it was, you know, circumstances combined with interest, actually, because I was doing research into sort of 16th century theology, and at the same time, my mother got ill, and that illness led to her death when she was 49. And it sort of it became like an inoculation that the studies I had been engaging with, I couldn't do it anymore. So I needed something different, and I was invited to join my friends who were members of this research group, the Deus Ex Cinema group in Iceland, and I sort of found an angle there to work with theology and film, focusing on. I mean, I was doing some work with the Bible and film, and then some work with salvation and film, and then finally a bit on the representation of religion in film, and I wrote a bit about the sort of the pastors as the pastors are represented in films, because there is a sort of predominant sense, these pastors are quite often very negative. There's a negative image of pastors in film, and I was challenging that, saying it's actually much more varied. So that led me there, and then.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how particular life experiences sometimes can have that sort of impetus. And sometimes it happens straight away. And other times, I guess, the metaphor of losing one's faith in something can be applicable. But there's sense sometimes that you need to move on to a different kind of wheel or whatever the metaphor most appropriate to this is. But it sounds as though it was also a way of rechanneling what you already knew. So it wasn't a completely sort of new direction so much as a reapplication of something, but you couldn't have done what you're doing now if it hadn't been for the other systematic or reformation theology that you had done, because that was the foundation. And I say this to my own students sometimes, that if you're going to talk about, let's say, salvation in film, you also need to know what salvation is. You can't just assume that because you know the film, that therefore it'll all sort of, like, you know, speak for itself. So in a way, it's interesting that, like, when I was at university, it was a very traditional theology course and I loved every minute of it. But it was only afterwards that I started to apply a lot of that into areas that my own tutors could never have imagined. So, you know, doing stuff on not just on death in the afterlife, but death in the afterlife as presented by filmmakers, not just theologians. So it's a way of, you know, building on that same basic repository. But in your case, why was it theology in the first place that you went to study? What made you choose theology as your university subject? Was it vocational?
I've sometimes said it was sort of by process of elimination, because I loved the sciences when I was in my sort of in the first part of my studies. I went to it's called, I think in English, the Commercial College of Iceland. It's one of these high schools, but with a focus on business and law and economics. And I went there, I mean, because it was considered one of the better schools, but also because there was a sort of family connection to it. There I focused my studies on mathematics, physics, science. And I basically found out I did not want to study more business or do business. I did not want to study law. I did not want to study mathematics or engineering. So I sort of eliminated everything but the humanities from this. I was quite interested in philosophy. I was interested in history, in sort of the interpretation of texts, etc. And I found theology combined all of these. So, you know, this was the brain working, saying, yeah, you should go there. But then at the same time, as a teenager, I actually began attending church. And I was one of those weird, I was once, I wouldn't say chastised, but people asked me, why do you go to church? I mean, you're a young man. Why are you attending church? And I said, it's because I feel good when I sit there, and it's a good place to be. And through my high school years, I would basically be attending Sunday services once a week. And it was, I felt it was just the right place to be. So that also, I think that was the heart speaking, or the soul sort of bringing me. And when these came together, theology was simply the logical choice. But as I said earlier, I was not there because I was then going to become a priest. And that was really never on my radar. So I was looking for different avenues of expressing my vocation as a theologian. And I think, to be honest, I think it's all come together, because I've seen my studies at the, you know, at the business school, I've seen them become quite useful in what I'm doing, which is this mixture of theology, communication, you know, film culture, sort of bringing these areas together. And I think the area I'm quite interested in is, on the one hand, how can you communicate? How can you sort of make the ideas we are dealing with in faith, in Christianity, in theology, how can you make them understandable? And I think film is film, on the one hand, is a good way of sort of understanding, but also a good way of being critiqued. So for me, when we look at salvation and film, you know, it's not just to say this film can be a good illustration of salvation as understood by someone, but it can also be, so this is a, we see in a certain film, a narrative which we could say, yeah, this looks like a salvation narrative. It's a story of growth, da da da. How does that challenge what we say about salvation in the Christian narratives, actually? So I see it as a very reciprocal relationship. But then I ended up being ordained, you know. So then that was sort of by, I mean, I was literally sitting in my office at the sort of in the national offices of the church, and the bishop at the time, who had been quite, he was very open, open-minded and sort of understood the importance of communication. And he sort of stood in the doorway and he said, "So Arnie, I was thinking of maybe ordaining you as a priest, as an online pastor. What would you think about that?" And I looked at him, I think that would be fine. Yes. So I was ordained in 2008 as the first online pastor of the Church of Iceland.
Was the actual, when you say an online pastor, so do you mean in terms of your job, or actually in terms of the, I assume you don't mean in terms of the way the actual ordination ceremony took place?
Very regular ordination ceremony, you know, but no, but my ministry was focused on basically online, you know, there was no formal online congregation. I was sort of attached to the cathedral in Reykjavik, because as a pastor, you need to have an attachment to a physical congregation. But I was tasked with reaching out to people online, which was what I was doing anyway, and then supporting the pastors of the church, the deacons of the church, in doing the same.
Yeah, and in that respect, how do you feel that the ministry has evolved? Because obviously, back in 2008, the internet was utterly in vogue. But of course, now I'm guessing, not least during lockdown, that there are more necessities and opportunities for you. In fact, in some cases, you've got a good decade over many other people. I remember Easter Sunday last year, 2020, just a few weeks, literally a couple of weeks into lockdown, the Archbishop of Canterbury was doing the Easter Sunday service from his kitchen, and this is just something that is just, you know, almost like mind-numbingly surreal. But in your case, I'm guessing that when you went into lockdown, it didn't seem quite as impossible to navigate your way through. In many cases, I'm guessing that you might even have been a role model, a cheerleader, if you like.
Well, I'm in a completely different position now, actually. So I mean, I worked in that position for about 4 years, and then I actually took on another position for the Church of Iceland, and 4 years later, I moved to Geneva to do something completely different. But of course, I think having done that kind of work has taught me a lot, and I think it's equipped me quite well to work, because now in my work I'm the head of communications for the Lutheran World Federation, which means I work with a team of people who are sort of telling the story of what the LWF is doing, what the LWF member churches are doing, namely Lutheran churches, and all of them had to adapt to this. And I think this means an openness, but what I've seen around the world is actually churches, both, I mean, some churches actually have online pastors who are doing an amazing job, very inspiring, whether they're Lutheran or others. And other churches sort of adapted very quickly to offer online ministry, online support. And what we tried to do in Iceland at the time was really, I mean, yes, it was important to have someone who could sort of spearhead this, definitely, but also just to make sure that all of the pastors, because you want to reach out to your pastor, using the necessary means. It means that, I mean, just because I'm using Facebook, why would I speak to a different person? I know I just want to talk to the person who is my pastor. And if you can equip the pastors to see this as a part of their ministry, then I think that can really, really work well. And we've seen many churches doing that quite well. I mean, I was very inspired by many things I saw from the Church of England, to be honest. I think they have a really deep understanding of sort of the digital church and online ministry, and with a focus on equipping the congregations, the parishes, the pastors, the deacons. But also, for example, the Church of Norway, which pivoted very quickly to sort of offering a number of online services with different functions every day that were not just coming from the sort of church house or the central office of the church, but actually coming from around the country. Just to name one example, I mean, there are many, many others. So I think we've seen, we basically saw churches around the world adapting extremely quickly during the lockdown period, and many of them doing very creative work. And there was published last year a book which was edited by Heidi Campbell, who we both know, and maybe she has been in one of your interviews already, where she was trying to grasp this, both from the perspective of the practitioners, the sort of the church leaders, but also from the perspective of the media scholars. And I think I took as an example in a short article I wrote for that book, the church we have here in Geneva, which is a small Lutheran church, which basically went overnight from having face-to-face services with 100, 150 people every week to having the same group of people coming together online, and did this quite well because it was not just about broadcasting, but it was about bringing people from where they were, maybe some in their kitchen, some in their living rooms, to contribute to the service. So the idea is not just that you are there to listen and to be spoken to, but you are a part of. So, you know, maybe one person is reading some of the readings from their kitchen, another is leading the prayers from their living room, and the pastor has three or four people with him, with her, in the church space, you know, taking care of that. And while the worship is ongoing, you have this sense of us being actually a connected congregation gathered online, but in our respective spaces and able to contribute. I mean, and of course, everyone commenting and adding. So I actually found it quite profound. And I think this time has been quite profound, but it doesn't, it comes in addition to, it doesn't replace being together face to face, which I think everyone also misses a lot.
Yes, and we were saying just before we started recording as well that's the whole thing, that there are going to be all kinds of new opportunities as well as challenges, a kind of a new world order of some sorts, because suddenly we'll realize that whereas we all thought a year ago that Zoom, in my case, was just a temporary thing and we'd have to use it for a few weeks or months at most and then we'd all return to normality, it's clearly going to be with us in a very, very positive way for many years and decades to come, and then something else will take its place. And it's funny, like watching all those old films, like the Back to the Future films, when they envisaged the future, which is now actually our past, because I think the future in the second Back to the Future film was something like 2015 or 16, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course it was all, you know, the flying cars, and yet they still had newspapers. So like everything had gone digital and virtual, but you still have the old fashioned newspaper that you would read. So it was like really funny to laugh at and to say that, you know, some of it was like way ahead of the game and other bits of it completely, you know, missed the point entirely. But in terms of lockdown as well, I mean, do you kind of feel that when lockdown does eventually end and things return to some normality, what would you say are your biggest hopes and fears for your congregation, for your present role?
I think we all miss being together, just as people in the same space. I think that's one. I think we hope we'll be able to do that, and I think we hope people will be safe. I think there is we've sort of been living with the lockdown now for more than a year, and with all of these restrictions, and I think it's been a time characterized by a sense of you're not quite safe, and I think that can actually be quite debilitating. You go outside and you want to, you know, be safe, and you want to keep others safe. So I can't wait to look back at this time 10 years from now. But apart from that, I hope we'll be able to. I mean, I hope we'll be able to come together, to be together, to sort of. I can't wait just to sit in a restaurant and you know, have a nice meal. I mean, I think that's going to be just great. At the same time, I think this has also opened up a lot of possibilities. It's basically accelerated a development of meeting online, working together online, which is also to some extent exciting. You know, I think we will have opportunities of engaging with people we thought we couldn't. I think we will have opportunities of taking care of some parts of business that can actually just be dealt with online, and you don't have to go there. And I think that's also exciting. You know, I spent a week because we've basically been working from home, you know, since March next last year with next year, I said. We've basically been working from home since March last year, with a few sort of, you know, we've been in the office at times, but never full time. And I was able to sort of shift my office during a school holiday to another place here in Switzerland. And I could continue my work, but I could also be close to family members. And I mean, this is actually very, this can be quite valuable. So I think I don't quite know what will be the reality once we're out of this, but I'm very hopeful, actually, I think.
Yeah. No. Well, exactly, because it's going to be whatever happens. It's going to be based on the new experiences, and we want to should have shed the things like, you know, we all miss going to restaurants, but there are also other things that we can hopefully be more efficient over, and maybe we won't be. I mean, my feeling over the last year is that although I've cut out the commute, I wouldn't say that I'm more productive or more efficient. You know, just the, you know, staying in the same environment, I'm not getting out very much. I'm not getting any exercise. But you know, and it doesn't feel that I'm getting more done in the course of the day when I'm stuck in my children's bedroom or whatever. So there are some things that, you know, it'll be nice to go back to something resembling what we used to do, but also being able to cut out a lot of those inefficiencies, not least excessive travel with all the expenses around accommodation and travel, which obviously was always the way things were done, you know, in the past, if you were going to a conference, for example. But Arnie, as we start to wrap up, just a few more philosophically based questions. Would you say, as you survey your life and career, would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
I think so. Yes. I feel in many ways I've had a very good life. You know, are there things you might change? Yes, of course, always. But thinking back, you know, there are moments you want to learn from, clearly. But I was reflecting on this last winter, actually, as I was remembering my parents, and remembering sort of thinking what sort of what floats up in your consciousness as you think of them. And there was a predominant sense of being deeply loved, which is what shone through. And I think that's a good feeling to have, actually. So yes, quite positive.
Yeah, no, that's really obvious, actually, from what you've just said. But I mean, would you say that it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences? That's the real question, isn't it? About, I mean, the way that we apprehend the past, and sometimes some of the difficult moments, the challenging moments. And, you know, do we sort of look back on them and think, oh yeah, they were good days? Or is it this, you know, maybe there's something missing in the present, and it's because of that absence that we are going back and maybe trying to fill that gap. But can you be nostalgic about those negative experiences?
I think you can, yes. And I think for me the best example is actually grief. There is an intensity in grief, which you know, especially what you could call raw grief, which is unbearable in the moment, and then you miss it when it's not there, because the intensity of the feeling is an expression of the intensity of love you had for someone. And grief matures like we do, and it becomes, I think it's deeply connected to the memories we have of someone. And I think to some extent the intensity of that feeling fades away and it makes life bearable. But at times you can also be sort of nostalgic about the sense of because there is something about it. I don't know if this makes sense, But I think for me, that would probably be the best example of being nostalgic about something which, at least in the moment, you don't define as a positive experience, but you might actually reframe your perception of grief later on in life, because grief is not a, you know, it's a, it's it,
I think you've hit the nail on the head, and it's probably the reason as well. I mean, obviously, people may have a commercial reason for writing about their horrible past experiences and so on, and celebrity autobiographies and so on. But often that's the thing, isn't it? That it's that way of saying that at the time something looked as though it was going to knock you down, and it was the most horrible thing, and you never want to relive that. But you learn something from it, and it's about character building. And it's not to say that in itself you wanted it or you would ever wish it on anybody else, but in having had it, there's a weird sense sometimes, maybe gratitude's not the right word, but having had it, it's almost as though you've changed irrevocably. And if you've survived, maybe that's it sometimes. Maybe it's a survival narrative, but the fact that you've survived in itself means that there's some hope to be taken from that carnage. I mean, would you imagine, you know, as your younger self, do you think that your younger self, 5 or 15 or whatever, could possibly have imagined that you'd be doing what you're doing now?
No, definitely not. I mean, I don't know what my younger self thought, but I don't think so. Yeah. I think, but at the same time, I think my older self would have said, you know, wow, think of everything that you got to experience. If I could speak, I wouldn't, you know. I think I've lived a life with opportunities to do such interesting things, ranging from, you know, studying fascinating subjects, meeting people who have so much to, from whom you have so much to learn, teaching, leading teams of hugely talented people, working with people, and I mean, you know, and then sort of some, you know, participating in some monumental events. So I see it as a privilege for which I am deeply grateful, but I could never ever have imagined it.
Because you used the word reciprocal earlier, and I think it works in our own lives that, you know, having that conversation with the younger self, you know, sort of almost it's a bit like the Shawshank Redemption, I suppose, but you know, that sort of idea of being able to sort of say, learn from those experiences, or don't do it that way, you know. But it's like with my own children, sometimes you tell them not to do something, but they're still hell bent on doing it, and you realize that actually you sometimes have to find your own way sometimes, because somebody can tell you not to do something, and that makes you all the more determined to do it. So, but do you find that there is scope to have that dialogue? Obviously not actually with your younger self. You can't go in a time machine and have that conversation, but you kind of feel sometimes that there are conversations that you'd like to have had between, you know, the present you and the past you, in terms of guiding you along a path which maybe you have taken or still hope to take.
I think so. I mean, I think I have a fairly sort of learning attitude. Learning attitude towards my past. So I think I am who I am because I've done what I've done. So I can't change that. At the same time, I mean, of course, there are things you would have sort of liked to have known at some point. And I think it's mainly about, I would mainly see it as being about, you know, going after opportunities where you felt maybe not, you know, but maybe. And this is, I think, then what we teach. I actually think that the learning we take from our own lives, we are able to apply to our children, sort of trying to encourage them to be open to opportunities, to possibilities, to do something which they might find difficult, but would ultimately give them an experience which is worthwhile.
Yeah. And are you still in touch with friends from your past?
I am, yes, a number of them. And sort of one of my best friends, we used to sit together from age 12, 13. through the years, and we even worked together, so we've been quite close through years, and I cherish that. And then, of course, you know, Facebook enables you to connect to everyone, so all of a sudden your old high school class is coming together I mean, maybe not for much interaction, but you know they're there, you see it, and you sort of rejoice when something nice happens to them, and
absolutely
send them a note on their birthday.
Yeah. Oh, no, I think that's very important, absolutely. And yeah. it's interesting because, well, I've got friends in the hundreds. You've got friends in the thousands, I think, on Facebook. So of course, sometimes you have the opposite problem, that there are just too many people to possibly be able to comment on and engage with day to day. And then there's the risk that Facebook can end up completely sort of like overtaking, you know, everything else. Yeah. But at the same time, it comes down to people. I think that's why I prefer Facebook to other social media, because it's the one which is really about people rather than about messages. And it's not necessarily about, you know, selling a particular person or skill for a job, as LinkedIn might be about, but it's actually about celebrating those rich moments and also reminding yourself of who you were, where you came from, because those people from school or university would have seen you at a different stage in your life to where you are now. And it's quite humbling sometimes just to sort of remember our roots. I've only been on Facebook properly in the last, well, probably about 4 years now, but I'm very aware that it's very important in terms of my own character building. My very last question, Arnie, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm probably a bit of both. I think generally speaking, I'm a looking forward kind of person. I am, but I do look back to my own past in order to learn from it, and in order to sort of, I think, also reflect with gratitude, you know, about that which I have received and that which I have been given. But I think I'm quite forward looking. Yeah. Generally, I mean, you know, to the close future and to the far away future. While I have no idea. I'm in Geneva now, and we'll see where I will be the next time we engage in this way.
Absolutely. Well, I hope also I get a chance to see you in person again. Much as though it's been wonderful to catch up online. But Arnie, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.